Reveal is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. So about this time last year, reporter Emily Schwing of the Northwest News Network told us about this radio station she used to work at. She said it had a lot of skeletons in the closet, and Emily was trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, it was in Nome, Alaska, way out on the Bering Sea coast, and you can only get there by airplane. I used to be the news director at the radio station there, KNOM, and it has this super cheesy, endearing sound.
Yours for Western Alaska, KNOM.
I love that. I don't think it's cheesy. I think it's perfect. I'm going to talk to Jay Breezy about changing the Reveal theme song. So anyway, what did you do out there?
I spent most of my time reporting on things like subsistence hunting for bearded seal. The Inupiat people there call it Ugruk. And of course, that 1,000-mile sled dog race, the Iditarod, the finish line is in Nome.
A northerly headwind blew between 30 and 40 miles per hour and scoured the barren tundra along the Bering Sea coast as Brent Sass used his ski pole to help his dog team glide across the icy trail to Koyuk.
Yeah, I didn't stop kicking or ski pulling or kneeling on the sled.
Okay, so I've been on a dog sled in Alaska in February, and it was so cold. It was thrilling, but, you know, I'm a Florida boy. I don't even like to think about it. So, Emily, what does all this have to do with the skeletons in the closet?
Okay, so it all had to do with this guy who founded KNOM. It's a Catholic radio station, and it was started by a Jesuit priest, James Poole, back in 1971. He used the station as his studio pulpit.
You know, it's not a disgrace to make mistakes and fall. All men and women, old and young, do just that. But after falling, just to lay there and cry, that is a mistake. Rise, start over. This time, make it.
I heard about James Poole's mistakes while I was working at KNOM, but I was never given any details. A year after I left Nome, I saw this social media post one day, and it mentioned something about where the church was hiding him. That kicked off my search through records about Jesuit missions in Alaska. First, I needed to learn more about the Jesuit order, so I called this guy, Patrick Wall.
Yeah, to become a Jesuit's a very rigorous process. They sometimes are referred to as the, you know, stormtroopers of the Roman Catholic Church. They answer only to the Pope, and they have the most rigorous training program.
So it sounds like Patrick knows a lot about the Catholic Church.
He does, and it's from firsthand experience. He used to be a Benedictine monk and an ordained priest. He's no longer with the church, but he knows how to navigate his way through piles of records, some in Latin.
It's really surprising to me how meticulous they are about keeping notes and dating their signatures.
Yep.
And
all you have to do is a little grunt work. That's what I'm saying. This is not rocket science.
Emily did a lot of grunt work. She spent the past year and a half digging through church records and court documents. She tracked down priests and people who knew them, all to find those skeletons in the closet. And what she uncovered is a new chapter in the Catholic Church's continuing story of sexual abuse. It takes us to some of the most isolated corners of the country, Native communities in Alaska and the Northwest. We'll hear from the accused and from the Jesuit leaders who moved them around. Along the way, Emily discovers how the church used a college campus to hide priests, including Father Poole, in plain sight.
I've only seen photos of James Poole, and in all of them, he has a broad, constant smile and dark-rimmed glasses. People remember him as handsome, and starting KNOM was his life's dream.
The radio station is a ministry. And it's also an educational vehicle to try to bring across to the people ideas that will help them help themselves to move forward in what is a pretty difficult situation up here.
of one culture that has been overtaken and kind of swamped by another culture. So we're in there trying to help them hold the gap.
KNOM is a cozy place. It looks like a house, and it's always warm inside, which means a lot in the winter in Nome. You can spot the station from almost anywhere in town because of a giant electric star attached to the antenna that reaches above the roof. A friend of mine who also worked there said if I wanted to learn the real story of James Poole, I should talk to a woman named Elsie Boudreau. A few weeks later, Elsie told me she'd be happy to talk.
I knew on some level, like I was waiting for you to come because there's still more of a story to tell. I don't know. I was just waiting for you. I don't know how else to say it.
Long before he founded KNOM, James Poole was the priest where Elsie grew up, St. Mary's. It's a tiny native village near the Yukon River. The Jesuits built a boarding school nearby and an orphanage in the early 1900s. And the church was part of everyday life for kids like Elsie.
So you have to understand that I grew up Catholic, and I loved everything about being Catholic. I was a devout Catholic. I went to a Catholic high school, Catholic college, and I grew up believing almost like I was more Catholic than I was Yupik. And they had a lot of power in our village, and which is true for a lot of the villages in Alaska.
When Elsie was a kid, she traveled to Nome in the summer to stay with her sister Florence, who's 17 years older. Elsie would babysit her niece and nephew and volunteer at KNOM.
I remember doing that show with Father Poole.
Mm-hmm. Like, what do you remember about that?
Well, I remember being in at KNOM, and there was no one else in the building. It was just him and I
on Saturdays. He was usually alone.
That's Elsie's sister, Florence Bush. She also worked at the station and hosted the request show. And Elsie says, for a kid like her, working at KNOM was a big deal.
So I was able to say some things on the radio, which I thought was really cool, you know. But then, like, when songs are playing, you know, he would kiss me and we would kiss and stuff. So it was kind of weird.
How old were you?
I don't know. 11, 12, I don't know.
I asked Florence if she knew anything about that.
No. I mean, I saw it. You know, he did the same thing with me. Like, he would kiss, and he would try to French kiss, and I would just like, what the heck are you trying to do? You know, that's not supposed to be in there at all. And he would stop. But see, I knew him since I was 6 years old.
For a long time, Elsie was too ashamed to talk about what James Poole did to her. Decades later, she filed a civil lawsuit against him and the regional Jesuit order. She accused him of molesting and fondling her. She couldn't press criminal charges because the statute of limitations in Alaska at the time wouldn't allow for it.
Father, you knew it was wrong for other people to be doing the types of sexual acts that you were doing with these young women, correct?
Correct.
Elsie's lawyer interviewed James Poole in this deposition tape from 2005.
Why didn't you think it was wrong for you?
Pure delusion.
Okay, you said that. What do you mean by that? Tell me how that manifested itself.
I figured that short of intercourse, it was all right.
Okay, what was there a theological justification in your mind for it? Was there a secular justification? Was there some sort of process you went through where you justified it? How did that work?
I thought I was bringing love into the life of other persons.
By engaging in sexual acts with them?
By being intimate.
And what's your definition of intimacy?
Everything short of intercourse.
He was such a scary guy.
This is Patrick Wall again. He's that former Catholic priest we met earlier. He was in the room when James Poole gave his deposition.
It was like sitting down with a major felon with a multi-felony murder thing going on. And when we all got done, we were just so... We all went and had a martini afterwards. It was just the most out-of-body experience.
Why? I mean, what was scary about it?
He declared himself the greatest lover of the world.
Patrick left the priesthood because of stories like Elsie's. For years, he says the church used him as a fixer. They'd send him into parishes after a priest was removed because of credible accusations of sexual abuse. His assignments were mostly in the Midwest, and his job was to smooth things over with victims and families.
Oh, when the families come in, that is so painful.
Your eyes are just huge, like dinner plates in talking about this.
Because I go back there immediately. I mean, I can feel being there when it happened. They've got a new younger priest who they think gets it, who they think that can then give them some kind of pastoral and human response. And that pain is so palpable at that point. It's oozing out of them. They're breaking down right in front of you.
After years of being a fixer, Patrick quit the church in disgust and switched sides. Now he works for a law firm in California as an advocate for victims of clergy sex abuse. That's how he knows Elsie. And Elsie isn't Father Poole's only victim. There are at least 20 others, according to her lawyer. James Poole never admitted to having sex with anyone. But another Alaska Native woman says he got her pregnant when she was a teenager. According to church documents and other records, Poole convinced her to have an abortion. Court documents also show he convinced his victim to accuse her own father of rape. Her father went to prison. And Poole wasn't the only Jesuit priest accused of molesting Native kids and young women in Western Alaska.
The villages are basically isolated for months out of the year before modern transportation. Those kids had nowhere to go. That's why we see a wholesale slaughter of generations by the Jesuits in Alaska.
That's really strong language. Wholesale slaughter of children at the hands of the Catholic Church is incredibly strong language.
That's what the data supports.
Elsie's village, St. Mary's, only has about 500 people. But between 1927 and 1998, at least 15 priests accused of sexual abuse served there. Patrick says isolated Native communities in Alaska and Indian reservations in the Northwest were used as dumping grounds for problem Jesuits. We found accused Jesuits in more than 100 of those communities.
In my experience, both Yupik and Athabascans are extremely welcoming. And that is a weakness that a perpetrator can exploit really easily, because they're going to trust that person. There was no warning from the Jesuit provincials. There was no warning from the Jesuit bishops of Fairbanks. There was never any warning to them.
Some Jesuits didn't seem to view Native people as fully human. I found a letter from a Jesuit leader that describes Alaska Natives as simple-minded. And another letter says they are people not advanced enough to give impartial and true testimony. Elsie Boudreau sees the sexual abuse as part of the church's attempt to erase Native culture and spirituality.
The whole premise behind the Catholic Church and their mission with Native people, with Indigenous people, was to strip them of their identity. And so sexual abuse was one way. I think it's intentional when you have an institution that is aware of problem priests, perpetrator priests, and move them to places where they believe the people are less than, where they believe the people there would not speak out. Like, I can forgive, you know, one perpetrator, right? But to move to and understanding that it was the institution, the Catholic Church, that operated in a way that devalued our Yupik people, indigenous people. That's unforgivable.
Elsie was the first Alaska Native victim to go public with her identity and the identity of her abuser. In 2005, she settled her lawsuit against the Jesuits for $1 million. Emily found letters that show church officials received complaints about James Poole's behavior at least 8 years before Elsie Boudreaux was even born. When we come back, how the church responded to those complaints. Emily follows a paper trail that shows how James Poole and other accused priests were shuffled around for decades. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Today's show is about a topic that's not appropriate for everyone. It's the story of Jesuit priests accused of sexual abuse and how the Catholic Church shuffled them around. Before the break, Emily Schwing with Northwest News Network introduced us to Elsie Boudreaux, an Alaska native who was abused when she was a child by a priest named James Poole. He admitted it under oath. Emily, what happened to James Poole?
Well, the short story is not much. He wasn't tried in a criminal court and he didn't have to register as a sex offender. Decades of church correspondence show very little response to concerns about his conduct while he was serving in Alaska Native communities.
So it sounds like what you're saying is people in leadership knew about James Poole.
Yes. One of the first letters about Poole is from 1960. That's when another Jesuit priest, Segundo Llorente, raised questions about how Poole was behaving with girls at the school outside St. Mary's Village. That's where Elsie is from. Part of Llorente's job was to watch over what was happening at St. Mary's, so he writes this letter to the priest in charge of finances for the Jesuits' Alaska missions. And here's what it says. Some people have come to the conclusion that Father Poole has a fixation on sex, an obsession, some sort of mental aberration that makes him see sex everywhere. Some think that maybe he's projecting outwardly what's eating him inwardly.
So it sounds like Segundo really had James Poole pegged.
He did. And many more letters tell the same story. And this is where it gets more graphic. The letters say James Poole spent hours sitting in his room alone with young girls, asking them about sex and masturbation. One letter details how he went into the girls' dormitory and moved their beds around in his own arrangement. And Segundo Llorente was writing these letters to higher-ups in the church. Eventually, the information in those letters made it to the superior general in Rome, the man in charge of the entire Jesuit order.
Okay, so why is that such a big deal?
Well, it tells us that knowledge of what James Poole was doing went all the way to the top, to Rome. But there's also something truly bizarre about all of this correspondence, Al.
What's that?
Segundo Llorente, he was also accused of sexual abuse, and so was the priest in Alaska he sent that first letter to. I found lots of cases of whistleblower letters exchanged between Jesuits who were also accused themselves.
So then, what happened to all of these guys?
Well, these same Jesuit letters gave me a few clues. I collected at least 100. I found a memo from 1948 that said Jesuits who'd committed sexual acts should be removed or resign. But that's not what happened. Other letters show priests got moved from one native community to another. It's almost like the Jesuit version of a merry-go-round. After people in Elsie's village started complaining about James Poole, he was sent to an all-boys high school in Portland, Oregon. But a year after that, he went right back to another far-removed native community in Alaska. And this happened over and over again with Jesuit priests for decades.
And did they ever get off the merry-go-round?
Well, that's what I wanted to find out, too. And to do that, I went to a library to flip through an official Catholic directory. It's this giant maroon book, bigger than a shoebox and a lot heavier. It lists every priest in the United States. I'd been tipped off about where James Poole might be, so I turned to a page in Washington State.
And then it says Spokane Regis Community and the address. Lists out all the names who lives there.
What I discovered is that when the merry-go-round finally stopped, James Poole wound up at a prominent Jesuit university with a well-known law school and an even better-known basketball team, Gonzaga University in downtown Spokane, Washington. Why would the church put a priest accused of sexually abusing young women so close to students? I went back to that 2005 deposition tape from Elsie Boudreau's civil case. Her lawyer had the same question for Father Poole.
So you can use facilities on the campus without problems, right?
Library, yeah.
And you can go by yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
When Father Poole was sent to Gonzaga in 2004, he was supposed to be constantly supervised and chaperoned. That's according to the rules the Jesuits came up with to deal with priests accused of sexual abuse. But that constant monitoring didn't happen.
Have you been interviewed by any students who were doing research on Alaska since you got to Regis House?
Yes, one.
And who is that?
The slightest idea.
Okay. A man or a woman?
Woman.
And she is a student at Gonzaga?
Yes.
Okay. And who was present when she interviewed you?
Nobody. It was in the front living room.
I started taking a closer look at this house where Father Poole was living. It's called the Cardinal Bea House, also known as the Regis Community. It's a home for retired priests. I went back to what I found in the official Catholic directory and cross-referenced it with lists of predator priests from a national database. Father Poole wasn't the only one who lived at this house. 19 other priests accused of sexual abuse lived there, going back as far as 1986. Most of them had previously worked in Native communities.
Okay, so what you're saying is 20 priests were moved away and stashed at this retirement community with other Jesuits, and it's in the middle of a college campus?
Yeah. And so as I kept digging, I started to notice a pattern. After these Jesuits got too old for the church to shuffle them around, they'd send them to live out their days at this retirement home. And their final assignment? Praying for the church and society.
Earlier, you said the Jesuits had a rule in place that these priests were supposed to be under constant supervision. Father Poole wasn't, but what about the others?
Yeah, they weren't either. I found a police report from 2009 that says residents at this home didn't have to sign in or out. And that same year, students profiled the house as part of a class project, and they interviewed another Jesuit, James Jacobson. In both legal documents and a deposition, Jacobson admits to using church funds to solicit sex from prostitutes in Alaska in the 1970s and 80s. And DNA testing shows he fathered children with several Alaska Native women.
So the Jesuits knew about these priests, but what about Gonzaga University? What did they know?
So that is the million-dollar question. And I tried to ask Gonzaga University President Thane McCullough, but he turned down my request for an interview three times. Instead, Gonzaga's spokesman pointed me to a memo McCullough sent to faculty and staff this fall. It says, "We must continuously work at educating ourselves and each other about the various expressions of bias, harassment, and abuse, and hold those who are found to have violated our commitments accountable." Both the Jesuit order and Gonzaga have argued that the home's not on campus. The property's owned by the Jesuits, not the university, and Gonzaga doesn't make decisions about who lives there. But it's on the official campus map, and it's listed in the campus directory.
So, Emily, you're saying these priests, who've been accused of raping and abusing kids and young women, were sent to live on a college campus surrounded by young people?
That is exactly what I am telling you, Al. They went to basketball games, they used the library, and they had healthcare services at the Cardinal Bea House. Now, I should say that I haven't found evidence that the accused priests offended or abused anyone after they moved into the home. Still, I wanted to check it out. So I went there one day with Reveal's data editor, Michael Corey. He had been helping me dig into those records I mentioned.
Ring the bell.
Yep, there we go.
As we wait, a steady stream of students walks right in front of this building. It's pretty nondescript. Red brick, square windows, and it's not really a house. It's more like a small office building.
Ring the bell again.
Finally, two priests, Father Max Oliva and Father Jim Torrens, answer the door.
Okay.
And Mike and I are met with a warm welcome.
Would you like coffee or something like that?
I'm fine. Thank you for the offer, though.
This way.
Inside, a long hallway gives way to an expansive living room, the same one where James Poole said he was interviewed by a female Gonzaga University student. Fathers Oliva and Torrens invite Michael and me to sit on a well-worn couch and easy chairs with floral upholstery. Another Jesuit, Father Frank Case, seems curious, so he joins the conversation, at first only for a moment, but he stays, standing, for more than an hour. Michael asks Father Case about the alleged abusers who lived here over the years.
Do you have an opinion as to why these things happened in the church or in the order?
A lot of the scandal was that people were covering up the abuse.
Which people do you mean?
The people in charge,
like the bishops.
The bishops, and the one of the reasons I think for that is that, you know, they would, if a guy was having trouble, sexual addiction or like alcohol addiction or anything, they'd send them off to one of these rehab programs. And then they would come back with a good housekeeping seal of approval from some psychologist saying that he's ready to be reassigned to ministry. And, you know, the bishops are not psychological experts.
Still, to be a Jesuit is to join a brotherhood.
One of the things I do, I want to reach out to the perpetrator, to the person, and say, "You're still our brother. We want to support you as a brother Jesuit for as long as we can." You know, they know they've done wrong, so you don't have to preach at them.
Father Oliva chimes in.
I think we also, you know, would pray for the victims.
Yeah, we do that.
You know. Whoever they are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask you, like, do you think that they get the same kind of support that a Jesuit, like you said, like you know, they're still your brother, would get?
I don't know, because that depends on their own families. Mm-hmm. Usually the provincial will make contact with them and try to be supportive and get them psychological help as needed.
Father Case told us he knew James Poole, the priest who molested Elsie Boudreau. He also told us he used to be the provincial here. He was in charge of the Jesuits in Alaska and the Northwest. What he didn't tell us is that while he was provincial in 1989, he wrote a letter endorsing James Poole. Case called him a Jesuit priest in very good standing. This was right after Poole left Alaska because too many accusations had piled up. A Gonzaga spokesperson told us Case didn't know about the accusations against Poole when he wrote that letter. I also found out Father Case used to serve in high-ranking roles for the Jesuit order in Rome. Today, he has deep connections at Gonzaga. He's vice president of the university, and he sits on the bench as the chaplain of the Bulldogs, Gonzaga's beloved basketball team. In short, he's a big deal. I now know how the Jesuits treated accused priests, even priests who admitted to sexual abuse. But I wanted to find out how Jesuit higher-ups treated Elsie Boudreau after she decided to speak up about what happened to her at the radio station in Nome.
We were like the sheep, and they're the shepherd, and they're not responding to their flock in a responsible way. And I became like a liability to them.
She wrote a letter to the bishop in Alaska more than 20 years after James Poole abused her. She says the bishop invited her to a meeting.
It took like an hour and a half to even get him to understand what it was like for me to come forward. Not to be a victim, but what it was like for me to come forward. He didn't get it. And it became very clear to me that he did not care about what happened to me. He didn't understand the effects of the abuse. He didn't acknowledge that little girl that was hurt and say, "I'm sorry this happened to you. What can I do?"
We don't know of any accused priests that live at Cardinal Bea House anymore. Some were moved again, this time to a retirement home in California that has more services for the elderly. As for the rest of them...
I found James Poole. He's on the wall.
He is. Yeah, you're right. There he is.
Mike and I stand in the middle of a Jesuit cemetery on a hillside about 20 minutes outside Spokane. It's a patch of grass dotted by simple white marble headstones and a wall filled with urns. James Poole is buried here, and he's surrounded by his Jesuit brothers.
I'm just going to look here. Kind of an assignment. Gonzaga priest assignments. Here we go.
I pull out my phone to find our list of priests. In our research, Mike and I found 92 accused Jesuits who worked in the Oregon province.
John P. Leary.
Who was he again?
Former president of Gonzaga. McNeil. He's on our list. Bernard F. McNeil. Coughlin, Doyle, Dominic Doyle. He was not a good dude. Francis Duffy. Yeah, it's interesting when you look, you can see it on the list, but then you start walking through the cemetery and they all sort of become
They're all here.
The same. Yeah, they're all here.
Mike and I figured out that 55 of the nearly 650 Jesuits buried here were accused of sexual abuse. That's 8%.
Like, you could spend all day here being like, check, check, check.
After James Poole was sent to Gonzaga, he was assigned a job reserved for priests who get in serious trouble, tending the cemetery, this very cemetery. And it's a lonely spot, almost silent, except around noon, when you can hear the sound of children playing.
So if you go through that iron gate and you just go down that road behind the trees there, I mean, you can see the top of the school through the trees. That's it. I mean, that's a K-12 school. And you can walk right up to it.
And that's exactly what Mike and I decide to do.
There's a woman in a full habit watching these kids play soccer. And they're all in their plaid skirts and navy blue sweaters.
And it's like a beautiful fall day.
And the little boys have little sweater vests on. Recess. Best class of the day.
The Jesuits, buried in that cemetery, were accused of abusing hundreds of Native children. Emily and Mike found that 80% of accused Jesuits in Alaska and the Northwest worked in Native American communities at some point in their careers. Like Father Poole, all of these Jesuits were shuffled around and protected by the church. Emily wants to know why, so she goes straight to the top. And to her surprise, Jesuit leadership agrees to talk.
This is not a distraction from our work. This is our work in this generation, is to reconcile the sins of our past.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. I'm back with reporter Emily Schwing of Northwest News Network. She spent more than a year and a half piecing together a story of how the Jesuits, an order of the Catholic Church, covered up decades of sexual abuse in indigenous communities all over Alaska and the Northwest. Emily, this isn't the only part of the country where Jesuit priests were abusing young people, is it?
Well, we looked into that. And in what the Jesuits used to call the Oregon Province, Washington, Oregon, Montana, Idaho, and Alaska, in this region, there are more than three times the number of accused Jesuit priests compared to the average for other parts of the U.S.
Three times as many. Why are these numbers so high in the Oregon province?
You know, we're still looking into that. I can tell you hundreds of civil lawsuits claiming sexual abuse against priests were filed against the Jesuits and the province in the early 2000s. The vast majority of those cases were settled, and there were so many of them that in 2009, the entire Oregon province filed for bankruptcy. It's the third largest settlement in Catholic Church history, and altogether, they paid out $166 million.
So, Emily, do you know what the Jesuits have to say about all this?
Well, I wanted to talk to the provincial. He's the priest who was in charge of the Oregon province during this crucial time in the early 2000s. That's when hundreds of lawsuits were filed for crimes that had been committed decades before. At his office in downtown Seattle, John Whitney welcomes me with a handshake and a wide smile.
Can I offer you some coffee or anything?
Sure, that would be great.
Okay.
Father Whitney is now the parish priest at St. Joseph's Parish. His office is on the second floor of a creaky old building in the heart of a hectic neighborhood. It smells like incense, holy water, and dust, and his shelves are crammed with philosophy books.
He has Kant, Hegel, Descartes, Aristotle's Metaphysics, Plato.
And there's a model of the Last Supper made out of Lego bricks on one of the shelves.
Oh my God, look, Jesus is holding a baguette.
A baguette of bread, yes. French Jesus.
Whitney was appointed to lead the Oregon province in 2002, only a year after he'd taken his final vows as a Jesuit. He's in his late 50s now.
The nature of becoming a provincial is they throw you in the deep end of the pool and somehow you're supposed to swim. I mean, there's a lot of things, finances, other things that hadn't necessarily been prepared for.
One of the first lawsuits Whitney had to deal with was Elsie Boudreau's. Long before he was provincial, Whitney went to Alaska in the 70s as a volunteer. He spent time in St. Mary's, the same village where Elsie grew up and where Father James Poole was first accused of sexual abuse. Whitney says he didn't know about any of that until decades later. He says he signed paperwork to place up to a dozen accused priests in Cardinal Bea House at Gonzaga University to live alongside James Poole.
We kept him in the Jesuits intentionally, because my belief was, even at his age, which was in the 80s at that point, he had been in an apartment in Spokane, he would still have offended. someone.
But why put him on or next to, depending on who you ask, a college campus?
That was really the only place that we had to put him that was, that I thought he could be monitored safely.
Did you notify Gonzaga University about James Poole and that he would be living at the Cardinal Bea House?
I believe we did, but I don't know. I'm not certain of that particular notification.
What about the police department, the Spokane Police Department?
I know we didn't. I'm pretty sure we didn't do that. I don't think we did. And again, there wasn't the registration of a sex offender because he wasn't, he'd never been convicted of a sex offense. So I don't think we did that.
But you are convinced that he did commit crimes?
I am convinced he did commit crimes, yes.
So if he committed crimes, why not tell the police department that acts as law enforcement for Gonzaga University that somebody who committed crimes, but like because of the statute of limitations, couldn't be prosecuted for those crimes, was living on or next door to a college campus with possible access to his target victim population?
I think we were in new territory, and I was looking for answers to how to restrict him, and I honestly did not think that the police would have a role in that, that they would be, you know, now I think in hindsight, perhaps that would have been a wise thing to do.
James Poole was deposed in 2005 as part of Elsie Boudreau's case. And the attorney asks him, quote, has anybody from your order looked at you and said, Father Poole,
what you're doing was a mortal sin. It was wrong. You inflicted tremendous pain and harm. You destroyed lives and you hurt countless women and girls.
James Poole said yes. And then when they asked him who said that to him, he said that it was you.
Has anybody ever said that to you?
Yeah.
Who?
Eventually.
Father Whitney said that.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I believe I don't know if those were the exact words, but yes, I did.
A quote like that doesn't lead me to believe that there was a whole lot of love lost between the two of you.
My mission as provincial is to love the men. As a person, as an individual, and honestly, in my own sinfulness, I found him kind of creepy.
Still, Father Whitney signed off on allowing men like Poole to go back to Native communities. One Jesuit, Henry Hargreaves, ministered to Native people throughout Western Alaska starting in the 1950s. In 2009, he was accused of raping boys as young as six, multiple times for decades. I asked Father Whitney whether Native American villages were dumping grounds for predator priests. He says no. But I still can't understand why you would have sent a man like Henry Hargreaves to say mass on Indian reservations in Washington state after he was removed from Alaska.
So it's almost like he was put back into the same environment in a different place. And so maybe while you're saying these weren't dumping grounds, the anecdotal evidence shows that it could have perhaps been that way.
This is what you love in radio, long pause, right? I really, honestly, I what happened in some of these accusations, what was the reality of the event, I think was sometimes minimized and not understood.
What I'm hearing you say is you did not have this feeling like, well, they're just Indian communities,
no,
so it doesn't matter.
No, not at all. Oh, no. I mean, not at all. It was not that at all. It was, and this is one of the things I know that priests or bishops and spirits struggle with is like, people, you need a priest, and we don't have any. And if he goes and is monitored and comes back, and that's, you know, just to go up and say mass and just come back, that kind of thing, not to live there.
So,
I know.
Our data. No, I know it's just hard, you know. Like
it's hard, horrible looking. And I had again.
I feel like you're having an excuse my language, but I feel like you're having an oh shit moment.
No, I'm just. I know it is a little bit, but it's one of those like, yeah. I mean, I was always trying my best, and I know there were times I missed something. I know there are times I miss something.
At times, Father Whitney drops his head, rubs his eyes, and pinches the bridge of his nose.
Do you think that James Poole went to hell?
I really feel, first of all, unqualified to answer that. And second of all, I'm not sure anybody goes to hell. What I believe is purgatory, what I believe purgatory to be, is that we all have to be purged of the things we hold on to. I fear, at least the last time I saw, Jim Poole, that I'm not sure he let go in the sense of owning up to what he had done. And I think he can't be in the presence of God still not willing to know the suffering that he caused. I pray that he does that. I don't know. Time is sort of relative when you're dead, but I don't want to send anybody to hell. That's one of the things I like about the Catholic Church is we may declare some people in heaven, but we don't declare anybody in hell.
Did the Jesuits create their own version of purgatory on Earth? After all, they shuffled accused priests from one community to another for decades and housed them under supervision until they died, quietly. They never lived fully free, but they didn't face prison either.
I think some of the people deserve to be in jail. We knew we couldn't put them in jail. I felt we had a responsibility to watch over them. And that's what we tried to do. Now, we're sometimes the jailers overly beneficent, overly kind. Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to be a jailer. It's hard to be a jailer of somebody.
A few days after James Poole died back in March, Elsie Boudreau sent me a text message. It was short. Hi, Emily. So Poole died on the 6th at 94 years old. A few months later, I met with Elsie and her sister, Florence.
I think it almost felt like he was a monkey on my back, you know, and now that monkey is gone. And I still, every now and then he comes into my dreams, and it's really awful.
It's awful because Florence once considered James Poole part of her family. She says at first she didn't want to believe he molested her younger sister. Through tears, Florence tells me she was a terrible sister to Elsie.
I feel bad that I didn't support her right away. But see, you know, and this is not a justification, but my life, I had more days with Poole than I did with Elsie, you know?
Do you really think that she's a terrible sister?
No. No, and I've gotten to the point where I think, you know, I hope someday you'll be more gentle on yourself and understand that your reaction, and I totally understand it, you operated out of denial because you didn't want to believe it.
These days, Elsie is a social worker and runs her own nonprofit to help victims of sexual abuse in Alaska.
Starting in 2002, over 300 children, childhood clergy sexual abuse survivors in Alaska came forward.
This fall, Elsie stood before hundreds of Alaska Native people and called on leadership from the Alaska Federation of Natives to recognize the impact of clergy sex abuse in their communities.
We know that this is connected to our historical trauma and continues to affect our people today. The effects of this abuse has lifelong implications.
Those implications involve a loss of culture. For decades, the church wouldn't allow Native people to speak their own languages, sing their traditional songs, or practice their spirituality. As Elsie stands and speaks into a microphone, in front of Native elders and friends, her sister Florence, her cousin Nancy Andrew, and two other women surround her. Later, I ask Elsie about that.
We don't heal alone.
and healing is possible. Like I'm no longer on that iceberg by myself. And while it's a sad reason, holding our truth up connects us in a way that makes us stronger together.
Elsie is not the only victim of clergy sex abuse in her family. She's the youngest of seven, and she says two of her other older siblings were also abused in St. Mary's Village. And her cousin Nancy, they all grew up together in St. Mary's, and Nancy says the Jesuits abused two of her brothers.
My brother Tom, he had a great sense of humor, very, you know, kind-hearted person, and I really miss him. And he, in the end, alcohol did take his life because he did self-medicate. He was one that didn't come forward, you know, against the church. My other brother did. So, you know, I know he prayed every day, and even though this happened to him, our people are, you know, we have a connection to spirituality, and I know he's in a better place now.
Florence, you just said the most beautiful thing.
What?
You just wiped Nancy's tear from her cheek.
Sorry. So yeah, these two ladies, my God.
Thank you, Elsie.
Thank you, Elsie, whispers cousin Nancy. And then we all just stand there. There's not much left to say.
Thanks to Emily Schwing from Northwest News Network for this story. If you'd like to see some of the church's secret letters that show how leadership covered up sexual abuse by Jesuits, go to our website, revealednews.org. Our lead producer for this week's show is Catherine Miskowski. Taki Telenidis edited the show. Thanks to Reveal's Michael Corey, Aaron Sankin, and Narda Zucchino, and to Sadie Babbitts, Phyllis Fletcher, and the Northwest News Network. Thanks also to bishopaccountability.org. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Original score, sound design, and engineering was from the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Caitlin Benz and Najib Amini. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letton, and remember, there is always more to the story.